Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So here's a story from the Department of Cognitive Dissonance. Two-thirds of adults in America are obese. We talk about that a lot on the show. It's a serious public health crisis. And even though there are now drugs on the market that can help people to lose weight and become healthier, there's a good chance that insurers won't cover them. Joining us on the line to talk about the ethical questions that this raises, along with other medical headlines, is bioethicist Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Art Kaplan. Great to talk to you as always. Well, Art, let's start with what Jim was just talking about, these obesity drugs, which apparently, even though they're approved by the FDA and there are new ones on the market, a lot of companies will not cover them at all. I don't get it when obesity is a legitimate health problem.
A lot of insurance plans historically in the U.S. don't cover prevention. They cover therapies or repairs or interventions to turn around a problem, but they have been really miserable about covering prevention. And you might say, why? Why wouldn't they, you know, get out there and try and save some money by covering prevention? I think the fear was that there'd be health clubs and lifestyles and it would all get fuzzy. So I think that's the history. But morally, it makes no sense. Of course, you'd rather prevent a problem than treat a problem.
Well, you know, beyond the morality, which I'm not sure is a huge part of the drug company equation, at least with the point you made a minute ago, it seems to me, I don't know the statistics, but since obesity is such a problem, since the dollar costs attendant to it, healthcare related costs are so huge, and I don't mean that as a pun, well, actually, I probably did. Why isn't it in their self-interest to do this, even if they don't see a moral obligation to do it, Art Kaplan?
Because it opens the door to all manner of other questions about why aren't you covering regular dental checkups? Why aren't you covering, literally, the health club membership? Why aren't you covering genetic testing? It's a slippery slope issue, I think, for them.
But am I right that financially, putting aside the slippery slope, am I right that financially it is in their self-interest that if you using these drugs, the odds of them helping are such that ultimately the healthcare costs of that individual go down on average?
They do, and now I get to introduce the grim side of economics. So let's say I work at NYU, and NYU says, should I pay for Art to take pills to help him stay slimmer? But they're also thinking, hey, you know, for that return on that money, Art's going to have to work here 30 years. And we know Art. He's going to wander around and take a better job or move because of his spouse or whatever. So you know what? We're not going to capture those returns. So one of the cruel aspects in an economic sense of prevention is sometimes it takes decades to get back your investment. And if you front load the cost, but then the person gets a new job, isn't in the same insurance plan, as our economics friends will tell us, that's not a good investment for the payer. Yeah.
So does Obamacare make any difference along these lines, Art Kaplan?
It does. One of the good things about health reform is that it does try to insist that health plans cover more prevention. So that is part of the legislation. I'm not sure, to be honest, what they say about something like diet pills. I don't know.
Yep.
But screening and testing, that's definitely pushed for. And I think that's a good thing. At the end of the day, we do have to reorient the healthcare insurance model because, you know, this idea that I'm not going to spend to prevent problems because the returns aren't going to come for 20 years, it just doesn't make any sense. By the way, the other issue is it's probably time to start to formally declare obesity as an epidemic, just like Ebola. We don't talk that way about it, but I think it's time to put it in the category of a public health threat or a public health crisis. That would also get the insurers on board.
Well, I also think part of this is the blame the fat person mentality that I'm sure still a lot of people operate with, because they're saying, well, you know, if you were preventing probably getting if there was some drug that would prevent a cancer, even though we're talking about prevention not being covered that much, I think the attitude would be different than preventing getting fat.
Yeah, great point, Marjorie. I think that's true. We do tend to see obesity, smoking more like it's bad habits. You got to change. You got to make the lifestyle change. So don't ask me to pay for that. But it is in our interest to pay for it just in terms of cost. I mean, we'd save ourselves lots and lots of money from treating diabetes and arthritis and all these other weight-related problems. And, you know, you've heard me whine about this before. I think there's a mixed bag on something like eating and smoking. You do have a lot of advertising. We do promote these products. They're legal. The budget battle between, say, fast food chains and the Department of Public Health in the state of Massachusetts is no contest. You know, it's Ronald McDonald versus a guy standing there with a poster of an apple.
You know, by the way, while you've been talking to Marjorie Art, I've been thinking about what does that company do that's aggravated? They spend all this money on this insuring you for this drug, and then you leave and go for another company. They should send you like 30 cheeseburgers to your new job. Don't you think that's a good, like a revenge kind of thing?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So obesity and obesity drugs are one of my obsessions. Here's another one of my obsessions. A bunch of states, this is reported in the New York Times the other day, have been passing laws that give critically ill people the right to try. It's called right to try is the term of art. Drugs that have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. I have been waiting for a good answer, and maybe you're the one to give it. If a person is terminally ill and they are mentally competent enough to be able to make an informed decision, why should they not be able to take anything they want to take, even if the consequence is more pain, as long as they know that's a possibility? What is the argument?
Well, the argument is not so much that people shouldn't be able to get access to things. These laws that you're talking about, and six states have them. Colorado was the first to do it. I think there are 10 other states lining up. They basically don't give you any help in getting the drug. That's what the problem is. So they say you should have a right to try whatever the FDA thinks or whatever ethicists think or whatever Jim and Marjorie think. And in a way, if you're terminally ill, I kind of agree with that. You should be able to try whatever might give you some help. But the laws don't obligate or create a duty of any pharmaceutical company to give you anything. They just rattle on about your liberty, and they don't create any money to pay a company. You know, let's say it's a little pharmaceutical company with a new drug, and they say it cost us $100,000 to make this, and we get enough to fill up a coffee cup. So if you want it, you're going to have to pay for it because we've got to make more of it. Otherwise, we're never going to get the drug approved. There's nothing in the legislation that does this. So it's feel-good legislation. Everybody politically can be for it. Who's against the right of people to try when they're dying? But it doesn't enable anything.
So it's really about right to access, in your estimate. The right to try is not as controversial as I thought it was.
I think the right to try has been there anyway because, you know, you see these campaigns. We've talked about a few in the past. You go on social media. My kid is dying. I've got a brain tumor. I want to get something. Please help me. No one's stopping that. No one's prohibiting that. It's just that the drug company can say, no, you know, thanks for asking, but we're not giving you anything. So that's where the bottleneck is. It isn't so much having the liberty to try things. And I can add one other thing. When the FDA gets asked about what's called compassionate use, basically the right to try, 99.5% of the time they approve it. They're not against it either. They get it.
Okay. Well, that takes care of that one then. Let's talk about something. We're talking, with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Let's move to the right not to try. This is a...
By the way, let me jump in and say, so I'm sure listeners are thinking, so now what? The answer is we had a whole, 3 years of screaming about health reform, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
Yep.
How many words were spent on paying for experimental treatments for the dying? The answer to which is none. So that's where the fix is. You got to create a fund to pay for the drugs or the vaccines or the devices.
Okay, let's move on, like I said, to what someone who doesn't want to try a drug or doesn't want to use a drug that's got a great record of success. This is the story of this 17-year-old kid in Connecticut, Cassandra. They're not using her last name. And she found out in September that she had Hodgkin's lymphoma, which apparently reacts very well to chemotherapy. But she and her mother have decided that this is poison, the chemotherapy, and they don't want to take the poison. Well, I guess the cops basically broke down the doors of her home a few days ago and said she was going to have to take the chemotherapy drugs, whether she wanted to or not. She's underage. She's 17, but her mother's gone along with her. What are the ethics here, Art Kaplan?
Well, this is a tough one, although I favor forcing treatment on her. And I mean forcing because you have to lock her up so she doesn't run away. You may even have to restrain her if she fights with you about having the chemo put into her. She's had two treatments so far. She's probably miserable from that. Your hair falls out. It makes you tired, makes you sick, makes you nauseous. There's no doubt it's no fun. The reason she says she doesn't want it is she doesn't want to go through all that. Well, I get that. But the cure rate from this chemo for her kind of leukemia, lymphoma, is 90%. I mean, it works. And the death rate, if you don't do it, is 100%. So given the power of the treatment, and given that her reasons are that she doesn't like how she feels or looks, I don't think that's strong enough. I'm a little disappointed the mom isn't pushing her harder.
No kidding.
To take the treatment.
No kidding.
Like, you know, it's great that she has a mind of her own and autonomous, and I hope to pour some chemo into her so that when she's 18, she can do what she wants or argue with us or sue all of us for making her go through treatment. But boy, it just seems to me, and the Connecticut Supreme Court, by the way, saw it the same way unanimously. When you're a minor and she's 17, but she's still a kid, you got to try and save their life if you can. So you can. And that's how I would, I think you got to push ahead. Now, you know, do I really want to tie her down and lock her up? No, I'd like her to meet some kids, teenagers who've been through this and survived. I hope maybe she could meet a counselor or a doctor or nurse she could bond with who could give her support for the side effects. It's only 3 months. Once she pulls through that, it's over. And, you know, I kind of think what we ought to do is get her through this with the right psychological support.
Yeah, but you know, and I agree with you, but ultimately, with the right psychological support, she still may say no, in which case you do have to lock her up and tie her down. And as horrible as that sounds and feels, I am generally with you. But the weird part of this case to me, having read about it, and her lawyer makes this point, is while she is 17 and a minor, she is very close to being 18. And on the day she turns 18, she does have the right to say no to this, and no court will intervene. Isn't that the case?
That is true. Once she's past 18, she can do what she wants. My goal is to get her there and then sort of have her decide what she wants. But, you know, with a lot of things in life, you're 17 and you're almost ready to be able to drive, but not quite, and you can't, and you can't sign a contract, and there's a slew of things. You can't go drinking. It's a slew of things you can't do with these age cutoffs. If people want to argue that we should lower the age cutoff because 17-year-olds are really competent, okay, then let's have that fight. But until that happens, the presumption is she's a minor. She has to prove to me or a court that she's really able to make sound decisions. Saying I don't like the side effects, they're really burdensome to me, I don't want to poison myself, I don't know. That doesn't quite meet the standard.
Yeah, I don't know what's wrong with the mother here. I mean, they would
right.
say, okay, we don't want you to go through chemotherapy. We prefer that you're dead. I mean, geez, it seems like
and you sort of say, well, you know, I don't want her to have poison in her body, which chemo is, there's no doubt about it. I want her to live, but I don't want to poison her. It's kind of like, no, you're not listening to this, Mom.
Yeah, but to both of you, but particularly to Marjorie, is when you say, I'm stunned by this mother, how about the vaccine debate in this country? There's so many debates where you would say the science is incredibly clear where parents decide that they're on the other side of an issue.
I think in the vaccines, these kind of parents would argue that the science is not clear, even though it does seem to be. This seems to be, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, Art. This seems to be more of a black and white case.
Well, remember, in the vaccine thing, it's prevention. In this case,
that's a good point. That's a good point.
Reversing the cancer. So she's got it. We know what's going to happen to her if she doesn't get the chemo. You can argue a lot of people aren't going to get the measles and mumps who don't get vaccinated anyway. It's true. I don't favor it, but it's true. But here we got to step in and rescue her. That's what it boils down to.
Okay, let's go from the sublime to the ridiculous if we can. Now, I'm assuming that you're of a certain age. You love Seinfeld. Is that correct? Yes or no?
I do, yes.
Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. So do we all. But when Marjorie and I read that Rutgers medical students who want to be shrinks, every time we say shrink on the air, people get upset, psychiatrists, some Rutgers medical students are being required by their professor to watch Seinfeld on whatever night it's on, you know, on reruns in the local station in Jersey.
They're being forced, just like poor Cassandra.
Yeah, exactly. They're being forced
tied
to watch
down.
It. And the next morning before they go on their rounds or whatever medical students do, they do an analysis of the prior night's episode, not for fun, but theoretically to help advance their medical education. Does that strike you as a wise use of time?
Not really.
Okay, well, that takes care of that.
I mean, there's plenty of neuroses in evidence in Seinfeld. There's no doubt true.
That's all there is.
Where I am in NYU, however, all you need to do is go shopping, and you can see the same phenomena. So, You know, I mean, is it, if it gets discussion going, if it's sort of a fun joint activity, if once in a while somebody can say, you know, what kind of personality does George have when he doesn't care about anyone else, blah, 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 he's kind of narcissistic. Okay, it's not going to cause much harm, but I don't really think that's the optimal teaching material.
By the way, the professor, to his or her credit, I'm not sure if it's a man or woman, it termed it Psyfeld, as in PSY, as in psychiatry,
which is actually
fairly cute. Okay, well, I was going to get worked into a frenzy over that, but apparently you're where I am, so I won't.
I mean, you know, it's fun.
It's fun, you're right. I'm
into
fun.
They can have a little
bit
of fun in the curriculum, that's fine.
Okay, well, let's move on to one that I'm not exactly in a frenzy over, but it's a little odd, and I can't wait to get your take on it. This is the Virginia couple that has given up their frozen embryos for adoption. They had a lot of trouble having children. They did the in vitro fertilization. They had 11 frozen embryos left over, and they were religiously opposed to getting rid of the embryos. So they've adopted them to another, so far, one other couple. What's weird here to me is that the other couple, and it's happy in one sense, but it's odd in the other sense, that the children are all, of course, biological brothers and sisters, but they're going to be multiple families with biological brothers and sisters that are related to each other but not related to their parents. It's sort of a new age kind of deal.
Why is that different than traditional adoption? If you have several kids go up, no, but let's assume several kids from the same family are adopted, and the ideal is to keep them together. But as the parent of adopted kids, I realize that some biological siblings are split up for a variety of reasons. I'm not saying it's great. Obviously, it's better to keep. Why does it seem so strange?
Well, let me shift the focus on this one a little bit, because there's something else that drives me crazy about all this. So people don't want to destroy embryos, but they also know, as part of in vitro fertilization, that you make more embryos than you're going to use. So you have a surplus. And sometimes you get a surplus because the people who made the embryos divorce or they die. Sometimes you just get them because people are lucky and they have a child on the first round of IVF, and then they have a lot of other embryos that they had enough kids, they don't want to use them anymore. So, you know, there's like 400,000 frozen embryos in the United States.
Wow.
The idea that adopting embryos is going to decrease that supply is just wrong. Why? Because think about it. The whole reason that most people use IVF is to get a biologically related kid. They don't want somebody else's embryo. They want, and I'm going to put this, I don't mean to be pejorative about it, but they want their embryo.
Right.
They want some genetic tie. We can argue about whether that's a good wish or a bad wish, or whether they should just get over it and adopt a kid or so on. But the people who show up at IVF spending $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a try are not there to try it with somebody else's embryo. So the notion that you're going to be able to not freeze and ultimately destroy tens of thousands of embryos because you have embryo adoption is just bogus. I'm not sure you followed that. But
I do follow it. Okay, the whole concept you find
weird. So the whole idea is weird. It's this boutique, odd, strange case, and we can argue about whether it's good for the kids and all that sort of thing. I kind of agree with Jim a little bit. To me, it's just adoption, early adoption, very early adoption.
Yep.
So, you know, they can all work it out as to whose brother and sister is whose. But in general, it's put forward as this solution to the moral dilemma of having to deal with unwanted or surplus embryos. It's not going to solve the problem. The number of embryos adopted in the U.S. like this each year can't be more than 10.
Hey, Art, I'm going to help you out since you work in an academic community and you're so good to us. I'm going to be good to you, too. When you started that discussion, you said this drives you crazy, which means you were not listening to our show yesterday when we read an excerpt from a local column in The Globe in which the president of Smith College, which Marjorie went to and which my daughter attends, used the word crazy in that context. In a speech she gave, and in the newspaper?
They deleted
the term crazy and put in square brackets that was an ableist slur.
Yep.
So are you chasing?
You know what I think?
What's up?
That's nuts.
Yeah, I'm with you, Art.
Thank you.
I get that. I don't want to be flip.
Feel free. Go right ahead.
About mental illness, but we all know that there's another meaning to these terms like nuts and crazy, and they're descriptive, and they're not about DSM categories of psychiatric illness. They're just colorful ways of saying, you know, that doesn't make sense to me, or I think that's goofy, or, you know, it's off the wall to think that way. That's too PC for me.
Okay, so we can keep that in the transcript of this discussion.
Yeah, yeah, you could say so. You could say so.
Now, before
send your letters to bigotedart at...
Hey, bigotedart, you're also a local kid. I assume people listening every week know you're a Framingham kid.
Uh-huh.
And because you're a Framingham kid, with a colleague of yours from NYU who also has a connection to Massachusetts, you wrote a little piece about the decision of the United States Olympic Committee a week ago, I think Thursday, I'm not sure, to make Boston the United States nominee for the 2020-24 Olympics. We've been talking about it nonstop. In fact, our guest right before you is the security consultant for the 2024 Olympics. Quickly, what's your take on the prospects, or not prospects, on the advisability of pursuing this?
Well, first, I don't think there's any other U.S. city that's more meritorious. I think Boston's a great place to put it, and I think they've got the facilities in place to do it, basically because there's so many schools and colleges and stadiums and tracks. That said, I kind of hope it doesn't go there, because if you look at the history of the Olympics and other big events like World Cup and so on, everybody goes into debt. The whole thing doesn't wind up benefiting the community very much. I don't think Boston needs the extra advertising or marketing that the Olympics bring, because I think people around the world know all about Boston.
Exactly.
It's not like Des Moines or Tulsa where they might want to, you know, promote the place as being better than people may think. And it doesn't wind up benefiting the poor and the least well-off. Some fat cats and corporations do better. So anyway, it seems to me economic impact, high risk, could put the city and the state into debt. That's what's happened in Montreal and Sochi and all these other places. And I don't know that Boston, to be honest, needs it. I kind of think of when I travel around, if I said I was from Boston, people say, oh, great city. You know, I don't get people saying, is that next to Goshen or South?
Yeah, but you can argue that Rome, which is bidding, doesn't need it. Paris, which is bidding, doesn't need it.
You know, and by the way, I would.
I know you would. But you know, one last thing about the help for low-income people, and I think the history suggests that you're probably right. One of their plans here is to build new facilities to house the Olympians and the media and all that sort of stuff, all of which allegedly, again, it's not finalized yet, becomes dorms for kids at UMass Boston, which is not a school that mostly is populated by rich kids. So potentially
and
there
the
is
commuters
some,
go there. Yeah.
Yeah, so potentially.
Jim is jumping on the Olympic bandwagon,
are you? No, I'm not. I'm an open-minded whatever, and I'm sure Art is too, and whatever. In any case, okay.
What's the podcast, Art Kaplan?
Going to look this week at this Olympics issue, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Try and continue the discussion at the, you know, see what the community thinks around the country a little bit about. Is it good or bad to win this prize? I called it a booby prize in my, that may be ableist as well, but whatever. It seemed to me, I don't know, it's a tough, tough call as to whether you really want to get this. And you know what my answer is quickly? Build two sites, put one in Europe and one in Asia, a winter and a summer thing, and let's stop moving this around and costing an arm and a leg to build a city every
Well,
four,
by the way, speaking
years.
Of that and helping an economy needs help is Greece, is where the Olympics,
yeah.
A lot of people think the summer games should be in Greece forever. That's
exactly.
Actually a great
you put
idea.
Put them there, better security, you know, you don't have to keep rebuilding the, whatever that thing is with the Velotron or whatever that place where the cyclists go. I mean, it's just stupid after a while. You don't have to move this thing every 2 years.
Well, Art Kaplan, you should look up Shirley Young in the Boston Globe today. She's got a great column, which basically argues the best solution is to put in the bid and then lose. Because
I agree. I absolutely agree. Get the PR and then
exactly.
Run away.
Exactly. Art Kaplan,
great to talk
thank
as
you
always.
So much. Art
My
Kaplan
pleasure.
Is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast, which, as you just said, is going to be on the Olympics. He joins us every Wednesday.